If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Thursday, October the 17th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow. My guest today here in Hoover's recording studio on the campus of Stanford University is Jim Sweeney. Jim Sweeney is a Hoover Institution Senior Fellow and a Stanford Professor of Management, Science, and Engineering, and a Senior Fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. Jim Sweeney's policy interests include global climate change, automotive fuel economy regulation, electricity market problems, and market structure issues. As this podcast is taking place in sunny Northern California, and I just mentioned the words electricity market problem, three guesses as to what today's topic is going to be. Jim, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So a week ago at this time, to the great question, where were you when the lights went out? Parts of the northern and central California were in a state of confusion slash darkness. Pacific Gas and Electric, the nation's largest utility, announced that it intended to cut power to some 2 million people. It did so because of a fear of high winds downing power lines and starting fires. This sparked a very angry Governor Gavin Newsom in California, Jim, who accused PG&E of mismanagement, suggesting they should give credits or rebates to affected customers. I guess we would call this electricity reparations, if you will. Here we are a week later, and the lights are on, knock on wood. This raises two questions I'd like you to get into, Jim Sweeney. Number one, how did California get to this point where electricity utilities or electric utilities are cutting off power? And then secondly, is proactively shutting off power the new normal for life in California and other Western states prone to wildfires?
Well, let me deal with the first one. We had, in the last few years, some of the worst wildfires that we've had ever in California, and caused by storms which led to fires because through the electric system, distribution or transmission lines. The city of Paradise burned down. PG&E went into bankruptcy. They recognized that if they didn't shut down power lines and more fires happened, they're going to be in even worse shape. Mm-hmm. So it's quite rational response to shut down the electricity.
Okay, and then to the second question, is proactively shutting down power the new normal for California?
I think it's going to be, and I think not only is it going to be, it should be. When we have windstorms and dry conditions, we have risks, and there's a trade-off. Do you have less electricity, like in some areas, that is, some areas not have electricity, or do you take a risk of wildfires happening and buildings burned down and people getting killed? That's a trade-off that we have to make, and the new normal is probably going to be shutdowns every so often.
Okay, you and I were talking, we did some email exchanges, we were talking before the podcast about this situation, and you mentioned a phrase that caught my interest, risk management. Explain what risk management is, how it pertains to electricity in California.
Right. We know that if we're moving electricity long distance, there's a risk. The risk is transmission lines or distribution lines may be damaged, trees, limbs of trees blowing into them, things blow over, may start fires. So that's a risk, and it's a risk that homes can burn down, people get killed. In a risky situation, there's many things that you can do in order to manage that risk. One, you can maintain by cutting down more trees. You can denude every place anywhere near any electricity line. We don't really want to do that in general.
Right.
But that would be one solution. Another solution is that we don't build any homes in areas that are at risk of wildfires. Well, we haven't taken that point of view. Another thing we can do is have more distributed power so we don't move electricity as far. Or when we do move it, we can shut it down when there's windstorms. It's a deep question. What is the right trade-off among all of those things? And that's what I mean by risk management. Understanding how you should deal with the real risks that are out there, because there's no magic answer, but there is trade-offs that we can make.
Right. We had talked about, I think you mentioned you saw the story, I believe, in the San Jose Mercury News about, on the one hand, there's a story about how people are upset their electricity got cut off, and that juxtaposes with the story in which people are upset that their power was not cut off because their houses went up in smoke.
Absolutely. Now, it may not have been the San Jose Mercury News,
right.
So I don't want to throw stones at it. There was two front-page headlines. One was electricity shut off in Northern California to avoid wildfires.
Right.
People are mad. The other is wildfires happen in around Los Angeles area. Los Angeles Department of Water and Power did not shut down their electricity, and it may have caused the fires. People are mad because they didn't shut it down.
Right.
And it was ironic that neither story referenced the other one. It was like they were taking a loan that either was bad, shutting down or not shutting down. Both were bad.
Right.
Risk management is figuring out when to do it correctly.
Right. Let's do a little electricity clarification, if you will, while I've got you here. It's baseball season. The Yankees are playing today. And Yogi Berra, a very famous Yankee, once said, it's deja vu all over again. To a lot of Californians, when the electricity got cut off, this harkened memories of the rolling blackouts of 2001. And I mentioned this to you, and you pushed back very hard, saying the two have nothing in common. Explain to the listeners the difference between what California went through with rolling blackouts earlier this century and what California is facing in 2019.
In the year 2000, 2001, we had a shortage of the ability to generate electricity. Mm-hmm. We had a combination of a drought, and we get a lot of electricity from hydropower. So the drought means electricity wasn't available. Mm-hmm. We had not been developing new natural gas fire generating plants. The renewables weren't available yet. So that when we had heat waves, we just didn't have enough electricity in any of the West. And so there was threats of blackouts because we didn't have enough electricity.
Right.
We had actually very few actual blackouts.
Right.
We had most, I think there was only three per day blackouts, but there were threats of them.
Right.
This is an issue we're deliberately shutting down. We have plenty of ability to generate, but we're just deliberately shutting down the transmission lines for a temporary period of time in order to avoid fires. Very, very different circumstances.
Right. Look, I remember when rolling blackouts hit my house in 2001, I think I got hit twice. And it was actually not such a terrible experience. It struck at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, lost power for about an hour, went out and sat in the sun for an hour, came back inside, went back to work. But I think a difference between then and now, Jim, in addition to obviously being the issue of lack of power versus just shutting off available power, was with what California went through last week, it was a question of how long. I mean, in this regard, PG&E did a pretty bad job of talking to the public about the situation. Some people thought they'd lose power for an hour. Some people thought they'd go days without power. This caused runs on generators, people panicking and buying provisions. Just a lot of confusion out there.
PG&E's forte has never been good public communication.
Yes.
I think that was a difference. But what was really quite good is PG&E ahead of time alerted people. And really, there's a story that we should all know and pay attention to. If this is going to be the new normal, and I think it's going to be, then for some people, if the electricity goes off, it's no big deal. You can't watch television. You you can run your laptop computer because it has a battery.
Right.
But the lights may go off, but it's not a big deal. For some people have life-critical equipment run by electricity.
Yeah, dialysis, for example.
Or people are doing experiments that are really dependent upon always having electricity. Or companies having server farms where they have keeping data. Mm-hmm. For those, they need to have backups. So the latter example, they have things like Bloom fuel cells, which allow a fuel cell that they can generate electricity basically 100% of the time and use the grid as backup. So even if the grid goes down, it doesn't make any difference to them. They would be something like Apple or any of the very big high-tech companies that have big server farms for computers.
Right.
It'd be a disaster if they go down, so they protect themselves. Most organizations and people are at the level of it doesn't matter, but those in the middle have to find some protection, whether it's uninterruptible power supplies or backup generators or fuel cells in their organization. If we know that electricity is sometimes going to go down, then people really should protect themselves if they need protecting.
Right. Let's talk a bit about PG&E and its future, Jim. Gavin Newsom obviously beat them up last week. The utilities, like oil companies, are very easy targets to beat up. Nobody ever writes to a utility and says, good job keeping on the electricity. Thanks for letting me watch the Super Bowl. It gets on your radar screen when something goes wrong. And sure enough, he jumped on them. But what happens to that utility? First of all, they're in bankruptcy right now, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Are they going to get a bailout?
I doubt it. This is a bankruptcy that will manage a lot of lawsuits, but they have enough assets to more than cover all the liabilities that they have. It's going to be a big chunk, of course, but I doubt whether at the end of the day they'll get bailed out for it. My prediction, but I certainly don't know, is everybody will be made 100% whole, but it won't happen quickly.
All right. Should they be in the business of offering reparations to people who lost power?
I think that's crazy. I think that was much more of a cheap political shot.
Okay. Should they be a publicly traded company if they get a bailout?
I don't think they should get a bailout. But they are a publicly traded company,
right.
And I don't think that they should not be a publicly traded company.
You do not think they should be?
No, I think they should be a publicly traded company. I don't. What is the alternative? Either going private or the state purchase them and become a public power state. You think the state of California will do a better job in running our electricity system than PG&E? No way.
We'll kind of look like Venezuela, won't we?
Maybe not that bad, but no way. Public power is not the way of going for much of California, although some cities have done that quite well.
Right. Okay, let's talk about the next player in this, the Public Utilities Commission, the PUC for short, in California. They have oversight of PG&E.
Yes.
How should they react to this?
Well, right now the bankruptcy court's going to be controlling what's going on.
Right.
The PUC should recognize the risk management issues. By the way, the Governor Newsom did set up a panel, Wildfire Commission, that came up with some actually quite sensible recommendations. Michael Warr here at Stanford was a member of that panel. And so there are good recommendations for going forward. Public Utilities Commission, by its very nature, tends to be a stodgy body. It moves quickly. It's a semi-litigative body. But I think that listening to many of the recommendations of that commission and moving forward is the right thing to do. And I think what they need to do is to avoid the natural desire of many people to simply punish the utilities. Whether utilities made mistakes or not will let other people judge. I think PG&E was a little slow in getting to the point of shutting down power now as they are now. But I think we should be figuring out how to move forward rather than how to get political advantage from punishment.
Right. Let's talk a bit now about the private sector, Jim. My sister lives in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, but she moved there a month ago from Wilmington, North Carolina. So she lives in a hurricane belt of the United States. Storms come up the Atlantic and they hit the Carolinas pretty hard. So several years back, she and her husband bought a generator for their house, figuring that sooner or later they're going to get whacked by a storm, they're going to lose power for days. They don't live without power. They bought a generator. Is there going to be something of an... I'm wondering if there's an opportunity here for the private sector in California. The opportunity being this, a competition, a race to build affordable generators for homeowners in California.
You got your tenses wrong. It's already happening.
It's already happening.
It's already happening.
So let's talk about this. How
already happening. Most stores that were selling generators were out of generators by the end of the time.
Right.
But it's more than just backup generators. I believe that we should be moving towards more distributed generators. I'm a bit of a fan of the distributed fuel cells in some places. Very clean way of doing electricity.
Explain what that term means, distributed generator.
Yeah, you can have generation in a big electric power plant and at some remote location and move it a long ways down to the city. Or you can generate it right close to where you're going to use it and not have to bring it down in transmission lines.
Right.
The example of the Bloom Energy of a fuel cell is one where you take natural gas in this very clean fuel cell. It generates electricity, and you can do that in the building where you're using electricity. You don't need any transmission lines coming down, so there's no risk of moving the electricity. As we recognize the risk more and more, I believe the private sector will have more opportunities for generating electricity at the point of use.
Right.
Distributed, whether it is in a more regular way by having a fuel cell or by having backup generators, which you use only in the time where electricity goes down.
So I'm a newbie to this conversation. What does a fuel cell look like? Where would I, can I go on Amazon and buy a fuel cell? Where do I buy a fuel cell?
Probably Amazon's not the good way. You go down to Bloom Energy and you meet with a sales, and they would construct it.
Okay.
And it would be a box that would be about 5 feet tall and about 2 feet wide, mm-hmm. and depend upon how many units you have,
right.
have between 3 and 15 feet long, and you know, have natural gas coming in and electricity going out. Mm-hmm. You won't smell anything because that natural gas will be converted to hydrogen and,
right.
and turns in fuel cell. And you can have it right in your building, or you can have it right next to your server farm when you're doing that.
And how much money out of my pocket would that be?
I don't have that data. The cost of generating electricity through the fuel cell is not too much different than the retail price that you'd be paying for electricity. Mm-hmm. Retail price, you pay for all the transmission and all the infrastructure. For the fuel cell, you're paying basically for generating the electricity. So it's not that far different from one another, but I don't have exact numbers.
Do you get any kind of tax incentive for doing this? If you put solar panels on your roof, for example, you'll get a tax credit?
No. At the federal and the state level, we've said we're going to have very large subsidies for solar energy, but not for fuel cells. There's sort of an asymmetry there.
Right. So we've talked a lot about how to keep electricity, how to keep the lights on. But what we haven't talked about is what happens when a fire is coming your way. It seems to me that for all these solutions we can have for making sure people have available, reliable sources of electricity, this doesn't solve the problem of what happens when a fire breaks out. So let's talk for a minute about land management in California and the fact that we're just building what's called Wilderness Urban Interface, WUI for short. We're building houses in places where we haven't before, and we're putting them up against forests, and surprise, when forests catch on fire, so do housing developments. This is the great tragedy of the Santa Rosa fire, that if just houses got wiped out because there they were next to the forest. How is the state of California and Jim Sweeney going to manage construction of housing and populations when the fact is the state's going to add another 10 million people in the next 20 to 30 years? There's an enormous appetite for housing and available housing, and you're going to have to go into remote areas to do this.
That's going to be one difficult trade-off. First, when we're at in a WUI area, right, wilderness urban interface, mm-hmm, we've got to recognize fires happen. And fires have been happening over a long period of time, and they burn down some trees and the forest would regenerate. Homes can be constructed so that they're much safe, very relatively safe, but they're not going to be 100% safe. Mm-hmm. You can have defensible spaces that can reduce the risk, but it's not going to be 100%. So the more we go towards near the wilderness, the more we're taking those risks. So that is going to happen, and I don't know what the right trade-off is, but let me throw in one more complication. We're going to have a lot more of autonomous vehicles and mobility as a service. Think about Uber and Lyft as mobility as a service. The biggest cost of that is the labor of the driver. Now, if it's autonomous, it's going to be cheap. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be easy for people to commute in from a longer distance. So you can anticipate that because of autonomous vehicles, there's going to be more pressure for building in the much more remote area, much more in WUI areas.
Right.
Add that to the population growth. So again, this is something where it's local and state planning has to start paying attention to. I don't have any good answers, but we know that's going to happen.
This is where life in California gets more complicated than people realize. So I worked for Pete Wilson when he was governor back in the 1990s. And one thing that he did, which sparked a big fight with labor in California, was he changed daily overtime rules in California. Labor loves to have 8-hour workdays 5 days a week. And if you work more than 8 hours in a day, you get overtime. Love it for the workers. What Wilson did was he had his labor board change the rules so that you could work 10-hour days, 3-4 days a week. This gets into the lifestyle question in California that you were referring to, because people live in remote areas. Let's say you're living outside the Bay Area. Let's say you live beyond the Altamont Pass and you drive every day past those wind turbines and come into the Bay Area. It's an awful, awful commute to do every day. You can soldier through it if you work maybe 3 or 4 days a week and get a 3-day weekend. That's the trade-off, and that allows you to live way, way away from the Bay Area. So up in Santa Rosa where the fire struck. So this is the problem again. Because the lifestyle allows you now to live far away from your office, you can get away with this. But this is the question for the state. There's one culprit we haven't talked about in this, and this is part of your forte at CEPR: climate change.
Okay. Before we do that, let me add one other element, that it's not just flexible work days. It's telecommuting.
Correct.
My son has done that for a lot of his work. He works at Robert Half.
Right.
He can work right at home, mm-hmm, and accomplish all the same things and not commute
and
in.
Telecommuting and Skype.
That's happening
like that,
all over. Yeah. So that's allowing people to be much further away from home and allowing more of the WUIs going on.
Exactly. Okay, let's talk about climate change now, because there were two components to the electricity problem last week in California. High winds, but what you didn't see too much in the story was as high winds complicated by exceedingly dry conditions in California, low humidity. So again, is this the new normal in California?
Probably. It's not just the lower humidity, it's that we have a longer dry season in the summer, and that changing in the rainfall patterns is, we're 90% or more confident that that's the result of global climate change. Mm-hmm. And the global climate change issues are getting worse, very fundamental environmental problem. And so not only is it the new normal, but there's a good chance that problem will continue to get worse and worse and worse. We'll have longer periods of no rain, therefore more dry conditions, and therefore worse fires when they start.
Okay, I see.
Add that to more homes constructed in areas where those worst fires can occur.
So I see a problem, Jim Sweedy. While you're a very bright man and a very powerful man, unless you're not telling me something, you're not God, and you can't change the weather.
You bet. And nor the climate. We can start addressing global climate change, but at the same time, besides mitigating it, which we must do, we've got to be serious about adaptation to the changing climate conditions, which means recognize that this is happening and take precautionary steps.
Right. So California and Western states have been addressing this, AB 32 most normally, notably. But what effect have laws had in the last 10 to 20 years in terms of electricity in California? You were citing some stats before you came on the air. I believe you said hydropower accounts for 25%.
Hydropower is about 20% of electricity. That's the big dams, hydropower.
Right. It's solar. Solar is a very low percentage.
Yeah. Well, if you add together solar, wind, and geothermal, we have a goal of moving up to 33% of the electricity, not of all of energy, but all of the electricity by 2020. Mm-hmm. We're roughly on track to meet that goal.
Right.
So right now, the combination of wind and solar and geothermal and low-head hydropower is somewhere in the 20% range.
Okay. And now let's talk about land management for a minute, because this is the one area where you can drag the federal government in the conversation. California has, as I understand it, not just tens of thousands, but hundreds of thousands of dead trees littering the landscape. So isn't it time the state and the federal government got busy and started cleaning out the forests?
I think the federal government should be cleaning out the forests.
Mm-hmm.
What's the greater amount of cleaning out and at what rate? I don't know. This is beyond my pay grade.
Right. Now, so Trump comes out to California and he talks about Sweden, I think it was, or Finland, whatever Scandinavian company is cleaning their forests, and what he's talking, brushing up the forests or sweeping them or brooming them or something. But there is a point here, though, that, you know, one cause of fires is sparked by lightning and dead trees, and boom, there you go, it's kindling.
Yes, it was the Rake America Great Rake America Again Great. Movement. I think that some of the dead trees should be moved out.
Right.
That had virtually nothing to do with all of the problems that we had. It had to do with storms causing fires and fires leading getting to cities that weren't well protected against fires, but Raking America Great would not have saved all of those lives.
But I think it does lead to one thing. When you talk about a large, complicated problem in California, you have to use that overword in politics, comprehensive solution. I hate it when Congress talks about something comprehensive, because it usually means it's a big gobbledygook of ideas. But maybe for California, you need some ideas from the right and the ideas from the left. Let me ask you this question, Jim Sweeney. If Gavin Newsom were to call you and ask you to be California's electricity czar, energy czar, if you will. We had an energy czar back in the 70s, didn't we, I believe?
So did.
Yeah, and then we had a Department of Energy, I think, which spawned out of that. But if the governor tasked you with coming up with the fix here, just tapped you on the shoulder and said, you are now the czar, and you actually can come up with policy, give me the Jim Sweeney solution for California moving forward.
Well, first I say no. But after I'm forced to do it, we've got to be moving towards more distributed generation there. We've got to keep moving forward to manage the grid for increasing amount of intermittent renewables. We know that solar doesn't give us electricity when the sun doesn't shine. Wind doesn't give you electricity when wind doesn't blow. We're having what we call the duck curve, where we have very rapid requirements to have our thermal electric generating systems on and off. We need to be redesigning the grid in order to be able to handle that. I like the cap and trade system. I think we should tighten down the cap and trade, move to less regulation.
Let's go back to the grid for a second.
Yeah.
Redesign the grid. So everyone says very simple, build underground lines. Is that what you're getting at?
No.
No.
No. I'm thinking about the markets and the management of the grid. We have, for example, wind that keeps blowing. The wind machines keep going, going, generating electricity, even in times where we have negative prices for that power.
Right.
And why would, when they could shut themselves off, why is that happening? Well, because at the federal level, we have a production tax credit. So if you're generating electricity that nobody needs or wants, negative prices, you still get the tax credit, so on net you go do better off. We need to get away from that sort of a perverse incentives that we have. That's the federal level, so we need to get that changed. But at some places we need undergrounding, and we'll be rethinking about it. Undergrounding is very, very, very expensive in transmission lines. In distribution lines, local communities, it's not very expensive. So we'll probably continue to have more and more local undergrounding. But I think it's continuation of the market development. I think we're going to have more microgrids, and we want more opportunities for creating microgrids where you have local generation and electricity cut off from the overall grid.
Right.
Stanford, for example, is a microgrid. It brings electricity in and it has its own grid internally.
I've been thinking about this, and this, I think, is what really perplexed people with the power being cut off. So I live in Palo Alto. You live nearby Stanford, I assume, also. And when the power goes off in Palo Alto because of the threat of wildfires, your first thought is, what is the likelihood of Palo Alto getting swept up in a wildfire? If there's going to be a fire in Palo Alto, it's probably going to be a Tesla battery catching on fire or something like that. So the question is, why is Palo Alto then tied into, and Santa Clara County tied into, a much larger grid?
Right. Now, you notice that in Palo Alto, what went out is just the foothills areas of Palo Alto, not the downtown. And that actually was in a risk situation. But a lot of electricity is generated central a long ways from where it's used.
Right.
And it's brought into that area. And so if the fire could be caused by the transmission lines bringing it into the city, those who shut it down, the city shut down because it's not getting the source of power. If you had much more of the power generated
locally,
and in that, then you wouldn't have that problem. Or if you have redundancy in the electricity lines, like for example, Stanford does not generate most of its power here. It had the solar cells, solar farms that it's getting electricity from. It's getting some from the grid, and a little bit is generated here. But some's coming in transmission lines from the south. Some's coming in from transmission lines from the north.
Right.
So if you shut down those from the north, you could still get it from the south. Redundancy of the system is another way that we start dealing with this. It's all part of the risk management.
Right.
You use the word comprehensive. You and I have talked about a lot of things that should happen.
Yes.
They're all interactive. They're comprehensive in that way.
Okay. But let's say, Jim Sweeney, that you and I went to the good folks in Atherton, California, Menlo Park, California, Los Altos, California, Palo Alto, very wealthy, very Tony's parts of California, and said, we want to do local electricity for you. Who's willing to have a generator in their backyard? Aren't we going to have a big fight over NIMBYism?
It's more than NIMBYism. You know, a lot of things we call NIMBYism is when we say not in my backyard.
Right.
We do something that's really harmful to somebody.
Right.
And we said, That's tough.
Yeah.
You got to suck it up because I want this benefit. You should pay the cost. Right. Most of the time, NIMBYism can be dealt with is if we recognize if we're imposing a cost on somebody, we compensate them for it so that they're not made worse off if it's going to be for our benefit. But the generators in the backyard, I think if they're just standard gas-fired generators or even worse yet, diesel generators, we're not going to want the air quality impact of the diesel generators, nor the noise, and it's not going to make sense. But if you had more brought and distributed, say, fuel cells, which you really clean, don't create yes. that sort of problem, that would people would not be able to object based on air quality or noise or anything else. So we could do that. And my prediction is that as we more and more recognize the cost of moving electricity long distance, mm-hmm. we will bit by bit be moving towards that more distributed generation, more of the microgrids that can be cut off from the main grid if we need to do it. But it's going to happen slowly.
Right. Let me throw another idea at you. What about the idea of either incentivizing, or a word that the free market hates, or mandating, with the construction of new housing in California, that new house comes with a generator? Either you get a tax incentive for the generator, or it has to be part of the construction of the house.
We have a law that does almost that, but differently. All new construction in California must have solar.
Right.
Either that's a generator. But if you mean a backup generator, I think that would be a terrible idea.
Why?
Because for most people, it's not worth it. For me, if the electricity goes off, I don't watch television or the lights go off or I turn on a flashlight if I need it, or I go to sleep early. Mm-hmm. Or during the middle of the day, I don't use the electricity. Why should I have to pay for a generator to protect me against something it's not worth protecting against? Mm. So what I do want is those people who have critical conditions. You're on a respirator, you have dialysis problems. Those should be able to get the generators, but that's really a private market solution. We really don't need the government mucking into that.
Okay, that is a great lead into a final area I want to get into, and that is the government relationship with utilities in California. So PG&E is regulated. It's watched over by the PUC. What about Jim Sweeney, the idea of the government developing, for lack of a better word, a partnership with PG&E? For example, is it possible for the state of California to issue bonds, to have voters approve bonds to build underground lines and have the utilities or taxpayers in that part of California pay back the bond over a period of time?
Sure, you could do that. I don't see an advantage over that over PG&E issuing the bonds and building the electricity. Who issues the bonds is really not that big an issue, because when the government issues bonds like that, they don't put the full faith and credit of the state of California in it. Right. There's a revenue bond. It'd be just like the utilities, so that the cost of capital wouldn't be that much different. Mm-hmm. Then you say, well, which organization has better ability to make the assessment of the cost and the need for it and ability? The legislators and the administrators in Sacramento or the utilities? And I don't think it's an obvious choice that Sacramento is better able to make that judgment. The Public Utilities Commission, though, does have the organization so that they can assess whether that undergrounding is prudent. In some places, it will be a prudent thing to do. Mm-hmm. And utilities, actually, I believe, should be developing such proposals. Do the cost-benefit analysis or the risk-benefit analysis.
But they're doing this in Paradise.
Yeah, and bring it to the Public Utilities Commission, where the Public Utilities Commission has the capabilities to assess that fairly carefully and make decisions. The public-private partnership is apt to move it away from a much more benefit-cost analysis to a political thing, and I don't think that's going to necessarily make us better off.
Well, I mention that because, look, the governor comes into office, Governor Newsom takes office, and he wants a solution for PG&E, so he creates, you mentioned, the task force, the group to look at it. So,
which was very sensible.
Which is sensible, but now reacting to what is an embarrassing situation for him, and he's looking at California political history, Jim, because if you remember why Gray Davis got recalled and kicked out of office, it began with the rolling blackouts and then tumbled in other matters, so perhaps...
Gray Davis managed that terribly,
right,
but poorly.
In some recess of Gavin Newsom's mind, he's flashing back to that and thinking, this caused big problems for another California governor. I better be on top of this situation. So you go from wanting a solution for the utility to now using it, you know, to beat up on it because it's a very convenient target. But this is really the question, how government can work with the utility and really what direction it wants to sort of help guide the utility in.
I think the system of the Public Utilities Commission being the regulatory body is really a quite good solution relative to you moving the government into it doing more. Now, the government has a lot of role. Right. The California Energy Commission has the citing authority for new power plants. But the utility or a non-utility would propose a new power plant, and they have to be approved by the California Energy Commission. But many, many years ago, San Diego Gas and Electric recognized that they were having problems of wildfires down in Southern California there and proposed depowering or de-energizing the electricity line in order to avoid them. Public Utilities Commission initially pushed back very hard.
Right.
San Diego Gas and Electric did the analysis and showed that that would be a valuable thing to do. Public Utilities Commission agreed. Mm-hmm. And they have been doing this shutdown for a long while without a big political complaint about it. It saved a lot of lives probably so far.
Right
now, hopefully we'll get past the political view of this and get back to a sensible decision-making such as we've been having with San Diego Gas and Electric.
So it sounds like you're suggesting maybe SDG&E should get into a room with PG&E and LADWP, Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Sorry for all the initials, folks. And maybe they should have a little PowerPoint presentation explaining what they did and educating the rest. I assume the rest of them know what they did anyway.
I've got to say, you got your tenses wrong again. That communication has been going on, I'm convinced, for a very long time.
Right.
They've taken a little bit different strategies. PG&E has now moved to a strategy closer to San Diego Gas
and Electric. Maybe it would be best for Governor Newsom to look at what they did and perhaps have the governor talk about what they did and use that as the model moving forward.
I sure would like to see that. That may be a little bit wonkier than most governors like to do, but that, I think, is a much more sensible way of talking about this for getting the economics right, maybe not for getting the politics right.
Okay, final question, Jim Sweeney. I don't like to put fellows on the spot in terms of looking into crystal balls because, frankly, it's not an academic exercise. But tell me, what is the future for buying and paying for electricity in California?
It's going to get more expensive. That we do know because the requirements that we've been imposing for a very large fraction of being renewables are going to make it more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
If we underground transmission lines, it's going to make it more expensive. If we put in more protections, distributed protection is going to make it more expensive. So we're one of the more expensive states for generating electricity. Right,
Hawaii's more expensive. But do you think
Hawaii's more expensive? And it's probably will continue to go up.
Okay, are we heading? Do you think we're heading past Hawaii in terms of cost?
Hopefully not. I don't think we're going to. They're off the charts.
So it sounds like the future of California is what I would call a trade-off for living in California for the beautiful sunny 70-degree weather you get every day. You also pay for $4.50 gallons of gas, and you're going to pay for a lot more for electricity.
No? Right. But the important thing to remember, our prices are higher than the rest of the place.
Right.
Our bills aren't higher because there's a lot more energy efficiency that have been built into a lot of the homes and buildings. And if you have a lot of energy efficiency, that is, you're using less electricity. The price can go up, you use less, your bill hasn't gone up. So I think that we're going to continue energy efficiency. Think of light-emitting diode light bulbs. Think about televisions that don't use power when they're off. Think about better insulation of your homes. That is California, and so rates can go up, use can go down, and our bills don't have to increase.
Okay, let's end this on a positive note. We have been talking now for the better part of about 30, 45 minutes. The lights have been on the entire time, and you know what else? Today is the 30th anniversary of the Loma Prieta earthquake, and the time that we've been talking, the earth did not open up and swallow us.
Hallelujah.
Jim Sweeney, I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. This is a pleasure.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to America's 45th president, and in this podcast, the state he so enjoys criticizing, California, and its electricity challenges. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. Tell your friends about us. Have them give us a listen. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows. It certainly includes Jim Sweeney, straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. In addition to being a Hoover Senior Fellow, as I mentioned, Jim Sweeney is also a Senior Fellow at Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. We call that SIEPR for short, S-I-E-P-R. And you can find it on the web at www.sieper.stanford.edu. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.